Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Doe against Cook County. Mr. Block.
Good morning, Your Honors. Robert Block, representing the intervener appellant, Teamsters Local 700. Your Honors, a voluntary consent decree not arising from any judicial finding of a federal law violation may not be imposed against third parties in derogation of their state law bargaining rights.
Mr. Block, might as well ask this question now. You and your adversaries and the district court all referred to a consent decree. And needless to say, that led me to go looking for the consent decree, and I can't find it. Where's the consent decree?
It is the term that I understand has been used to refer to a series of orders, the memorandum of agreement, the agreed supplemental order, and the modified implementation plan.
And my understanding is a consent decree is a judgment issued by a court based usually on the party's agreement and also on judicial findings. And under the Prison Litigation Reform Act, there have to be particular findings made to support a consent decree. I can't find any place where those findings are made. And for that matter, I can't find any judgment of the court. This case appears to have been settled and dismissed in 2002 without a judicial decree. Now, am I misunderstanding things?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. There certainly has been no order entered in this case containing any findings that any federal law has ever been violated. And, in fact, the defendants continue to expressly deny that they ever violated any federal law.
Well, I will obviously be asking this question of your adversaries, but the reason I'm asking this, besides the fact that the Prison Litigation Reform Act requires findings that appear never to have been made, is that the Supreme Court held in a case called Kokkonen that if the parties settle and dismiss their case, the federal court lacks jurisdiction to make additional orders. The settlement is just a contract, and unless there's diversity of citizenship, it has to be enforced in state court under state law. Now, Kokkonen said, A, that that's a question of subject matter jurisdiction, so it's something we got to raise on our own, but also that a district court can reserve jurisdiction to enforce the settlement, but he can't do anything more than just enforce the settlement. And what appears to have happened here, again, this may be quite wrong, based on what work I've been able to do, the parties settled their case in 2002. It was dismissed without a judicial order. And the judge has then made supplemental orders on his own without PLRA findings. That looks to be a problem under Kokkonen. And since that's a jurisdictional issue and none of the parties has discussed it, we have a problem.
Understood, Your Honor. Beyond the deficiency in jurisdiction that the court has identified, there are other obvious problems with the order entered by the court on June the 23rd, 2010, which is the subject of this appeal. It plainly exceeded the authority granted to the court under the original, shall we call them, agreements by which this case was initially terminated. There is nothing in those agreements, the memorandum of agreement, the agreed supplemental order, the modified implementation plan, which together comprise 196 pages, very thorough, specific agreement. Nothing within those agreements that authorizes the requalification plan that is being undertaken by order of the district court and the matter currently before this court. The modified implementation plan requires training of the direct care staff. It requires monitoring of collective bargaining negotiations. Not interference with those negotiations, but monitoring of those negotiations. The modified implementation plan, which is in the district court record as docket 273-40, exhibit I to the plan, specifically reviews training for direct care staff. And it provides at page 17, this training shall have a competency-based component. Individuals that do not demonstrate competency must be provided additional training. until competency can be demonstrated. Plainly, the plan, designed by the plaintiff's own expert, only called upon training for the staff, not wholesale requalification. Under the requalification plan, this incumbent staff
have... Were PLRA findings made in connection with that order?
The modified implementation plan?
Yes.
I don't believe that the plan itself contains any PLRA recitals. They are found...
I don't particularly care about whether the parties have drafted some recital. I care about findings made by the district judge.
Well, again, Your Honor, I don't believe that there were ever any findings entered in this case that anyone has violated any federal law.
Well, the PLRA requires finding not only that there was a violation of federal law, but also that the remedy is the least intrusive remedy possible to remedy that violation. And you say there were no such findings, so I'll obviously be asking your adversary about that.
Let me add that the PLRA has another component, Section A1B3, which relates to orders that exceed authority under state law. And this order, the June 23rd order, does because it abrogates the state law rights of the employees to engage in collective bargaining. When there is interference with state law, the PLA also provides that no such relief may be granted unless no other relief will correct the violation of the federal right. It must be impossible to identify any relief that would fulfill the needs of that mandate, of the violation that's never been shown in this case. And there's more than a mere legal problem without finding any federal law violation. There's a practical problem. In the absence of any findings by the court that federal law has been violated, how are we to determine what acts were the illegal acts? What conduct must be undertaken to remedy those acts? We don't have any.
Is the union entitled to relief under the PLRA? Are they a proper party to pursue that?
We're not aware of any precedent that prevents the union from raising this issue. And certainly the court is free to consider it. Without a finding of what the violation is, how are we to determine what action must be taken? There are no parameters. The only orders that exist are those that were established by agreement of the parties as to changes that they were going to implement at the juvenile detention center. But there's nothing in that order that gives us any basis to say, to evaluate when, if ever, state law rights can be interfered with as they are here. And plainly, there is a bargaining right. The right to preserve one's job is the most fundamental collective bargaining right that can be sought or achieved by employees. It's more important than wages. It's more important than benefits. It's more important than hours. It's the right to be employed. There is no more fundamental right. And that right has been denied here. And in the precedents that we've cited under state law, clearly there is such a bargaining right. And the confusion we believe shown by the other parties in this case is their failure to distinguish between the enhanced job duties that the transitional administrator has established and the effect of those job duties, those changes in the job duties, on the incumbent staff. We do not dispute that the transitional administrator has the right under the agreements or under Illinois law as a management prerogative to redefine the jobs, to include enhanced duties, to include enhanced training and responsibilities. But the impact of that on the incumbent employee.
I don't understand how the transitional administrator could have any rights under Illinois law. Illinois law gives the administration of this system to the court. District court has apparently enjoined implementation of what looks like a valid state law placing this administrative duty in the court. Transitional administrator looks like an officious intermeddler. Now, if there were a finding that the existence of this entity is essential to solve a violation of federal law, then I could see what's going on. But otherwise, the mere existence of the transitional administrator seems to be illegal.
I was surmising that the transitional administrator, if his appointment is legal, must be in compliance with state law only because that is the directive of the appointment order. under which he serves.
Except the transitional administrator is not the appointing authority under state law. Right? He is some kind of official appointed by a federal court. State law provides for something else. That's why I'm looking for findings that would be essential to disrupt the application of state law. And that, you know, as I say, I'll ask your adversary, but I haven't found any.
And I agree with Your Honor. Let me add that the district court went even farther to find that there was no basis to conclude that any of the direct care staff permanently employed constitute any threat whatsoever to the residents of that facility. The district court found there has been no judicial finding that purging the JTDC of incumbent direct care employees is necessary to correct plaintiffs' alleged constitutional violations, nor has there been a specific finding that JTDC residents currently face an ongoing danger to health and safety due to unqualified staff staying in their current positions. There's simply no basis for finding or for interfering with the employees' state law rights in this case. And those state law rights, as I alluded to, have been established under several precedents under Illinois law. Perhaps the most instructive is CIRMAC Health Services, where the establishment of new standards for emergency medical technicians was mandated by a change in the civil service statute. And while the implementation of those changes was required by law, the impact of those changes on the incumbent employees, which would have affected their right to maintain their employment, was found to be a subject of bargaining. The management prerogatives must be balanced against the right to bargain. And the district court here made no findings that the benefits were outweighed by the burdens, no factual findings in that conclusion. When the district court applied the balancing test, it simply made a legal conclusion, that the transitional administrator has a need for speed and the bargaining will simply cause delay. But the district court made no actual findings on those matters. He did not determine when the transitional administrator intends to open those new centers, how long it would take him to hire this new staff. We know from his filings that he's hired about 15 a month. There's potentially 225 positions. How long would it take to negotiate? And how burdensome would that be? No finding was ever made. No factual findings were made. Only a legal conclusory balancing test. And we submit that that balancing test, that conclusion was an error. With regard to the subjects that the employees would bargain over if they were allowed to exercise their rights under state law, rights that have been no valid reason for intruding upon in this case, they would negotiate over the testing to assess skills, training to overcome any deficiencies that they may currently have, a trial period in the new positions, evaluations of their performance, and if they are unable to succeed in the new positions, alternative employment other than direct care positions at the JTDC. Rather than a sink or swim approach that the transitional administrator has decided upon through his requalification exam process, the test that he is administering to the employees could be used as a diagnostic tool. Let them understand, identify the shortcomings, if any, that they have in meeting the new requirements of the job and remedying them. Through, for example, reporting skills or use of restraint techniques. Give them the opportunity to bargain over what qualifications they require to meet the new needs of the position. The training. None of the new hires have received the training before they came to work for the facility. They get the training after they come to work. So the cognitive behavioral training and all the other, the restraint techniques, all those matters that the transitional administrator is insisting that the new employees utilize, those are all taught after they're on the payroll. There's no reason why the incumbent employees can't bargain over their opportunity to get those training up, to get that training, so that they also can perform the new duties and utilize the enhanced techniques. Obtaining college degrees. the transitional administrator now acknowledges that it's not clear whether there even is a requirement that all employees must have college degrees. If it's not required by state law, then there are several matters that could be bargained over that. Could there be exemptions for it? Employees who are senior or nearing retirement, could they be found exempt if they have a hardship? When the degrees could be obtained, and whether assistance will be provided. That, by the way, is the only matter that the transitional administrator has agreed to bargain about with the union, but he has not agreed to bargain about any other matters affecting it. For example, a probationary or trial period, a trial period for the incumbent employees to demonstrate their mastery of the new positions, or finally, transfers. If they can't fulfill the obligations of the new position, allow them to transfer to a non-direct care position within the JTDC. These are all obvious matters of bargaining affecting fundamental employment rights that the employees have a right under Illinois law to exercise. And the district court order simply brushes aside all of Illinois law, all of these fundamental rights, without any findings, without any actual findings of fact that these are burdensome obligations on the transitional administrator. We don't believe that to be the case. Any further questions from the court?
Doesn't look like it.
I'll reserve the rest of it. Thank you.
Mr. Wolf. Do not touch the microphones.
Sorry.
If you think they're too high, there's a switch. You can lower the podium.
If you can hear me, Your Honor, I will not touch them or pull the switch. May it please the court, my name is Benjamin Wolf. I represent the plaintiff children. Your Honor, I'd like to start with the questions that you asked Judge Easterbrook. The district court, in all respects, has complied with Kekkonen and the Prison Litigation Reform Act. When it approved the Memorandum of Agreement, which meets the definition, by the way, of a consent decree under the Prison Litigation Reform Act, although we don't refer it to as a consent decree, which is document number 71. The court dismissed without prejudice the case, and it said specifically the following two.
A consent decree is entered. The case is not dismissed without prejudice. A consent decree is an injunction entered by the court. That's not a dismissal. It's a final decision by the court. When a court dismisses a case without prejudice, it doesn't enter a judgment, and therefore one would think there's no consent decree.
Your Honor, you won't find us in our briefs referring to it as a consent decree, but what it is an agreement the court reserved jurisdiction to enforce, and it is therefore under Kekkonen enforceable. In document 71 in the district court docket, the district court did two things. First, in its ruling, it said this action is dismissed without prejudice, as the court has noted, pursuant to the agreement, and the court shall retain jurisdiction over the parties and this action to enter any orders necessary or appropriate to enforce, modify, or take any other appropriate action with regard to the terms of this agreement. So the court did exactly what the Supreme Court said it had to do in Kekkonen to make an agreement enforceable. It reserved jurisdiction to enforce it. The second thing which got lost in the union's argument, and to some degree...
At that time, make the findings required by the Prison Litigation Reform Act?
Yes, it did. And that was paragraph 2 of the court's order in docket 71. It said, this agreement is in full compliance with the requirements for settlement of a class action pursuant to the Prison Litigation Reform Act, 18 U.S. Code 3626, including the specific requirements of 18 U.S. Code 3626A concerning prospective injunctive relief. So the court did
make the findings.
That is
citing a statute differs from making findings. I'm looking for a finding by the court on the questions posed by the PLRA.
Your Honor, the court said the statute complied. The settlement complied with the statute.
You have to make findings. You can't just wave your hand, cite a statute. Right? The Prison Litigation Reform Act calls for findings and conclusions. Are they ever made?
Your Honor, respectfully, that elevates form over substance. The court looked at the statute. We discussed it with the court. We submitted lengthy... I'm sorry, were you asking something, Your Honor? We submitted lengthy expert reports. This wasn't just some rubber stamp. We submitted lengthy expert reports. The defendants didn't disagree. Everybody knew this place was a mess.
Unfortunately, when a court doesn't make findings, the word rubber stamp is entirely appropriate.
Your Honor,
now, are there any findings when the TA is created that the creation of the transitional administrator is the least restrictive alternative required to comply with the Constitution?
There is a similar, I would call it a finding, Your Honor, in paragraph 3, document 330 of the order appointing the transitional administrator. And by the way, there was no dispute with the mountain of evidence from court-appointed experts about how horrible the place was that this agreement also complied with the Prison Litigation Reform Act. The court said, the parties agree, and the court finds, using the word finding, that this order is in full compliance, this is paragraph 3 of document 330, with the requirements for settlement of class actions and prospective injunctive relief pursuant to the Prison Litigation Reform Act, 18 U.S. Code 3626. It elevates form over substance to suggest the court didn't know what it was doing.
Well, courts of appeals really need findings. Actually, the TS, Prison Litigation Reform Act, requires findings. You know, some explanation by the district court about why nothing other than the transitional administrator would comply with the Constitution, why turning over administration of this prison to the Circuit Court of Cook County, as state law requires, would be unconstitutional, right? District court never explained why it would violate the Constitution of the United States to have the Circuit Court of Cook County administer these prisons.
There was no such finding, and there has been no such finding.
And there's a specific reservation or denial by the county that there were constitutional violations in the MOA.
The MOA, which was not signed by the district court, he approved jurisdiction to enforce it, but the order he signed made the Prison Litigation Reform Act finding.
You say there's no dispute about whether there were constitutional violations. It seems to me that the county's position is a dispute.
Well, first of all, there was no such finding in the order appointing the transitional administrator. The county asked for self-serving language that it didn't want to be admitting it had done anything wrong. And we didn't see the problem with that because the court was going to find, that wasn't a finding. That
was the county's find with no explanation at all. Could you articulate now on your feet why it would violate the Constitution of the United States for the Circuit Court of Cook County to administer this prison?
Your Honor, nobody has told the Circuit Court of Cook County that it can't administer this prison.
Yes, the district court has. That's what the transitional administrator is all about.
No, Your Honor, the transitional administrator was appointed before the statute came into effect, and I believe before it was signed, authorizing
the district
the
court's order that we are reviewing says that the transitional administrator is to keep control of the prison. And when the transitional administrator is done, then the district court will allow the state law to take effect. Sounds like the district court thinks he has enjoined the state law, but perhaps can you explain why you think it's a violation of the Constitution for the Circuit Court of Cook County to administer this prison?
The Circuit Court of Cook County has the authority under state law to appoint a superintendent and to assert its authority to begin to take over the facility. If the Circuit Court of Cook County wanted to do that, which it has chosen not to do,
address this issue, or are you filibustering?
I'm not filibustering, Your Honor. There is no court decision saying that the decision you're asking for doesn't exist. Nobody has ruled that the Circuit Court can't assert jurisdiction. We haven't faced that issue.
Right.
The Circuit Court chose not to assert jurisdiction.
If we abolish the transitional administrator and say the state law, which appears to me to be perfectly constitutional, is now in effect.
If the Circuit Court of Cook County appoints a superintendent, we would, if the Circuit Court wished, we would litigate the issue of whether under the Prison Litigation Reform Act and the Constitution, the transitional administrator's appointment should disappear. We believe the record still shows, and the undisputed record in this case clearly shows, children are subjected to danger and chaos and serious physical harm at the facility. And that is why I believe the Circuit Court,
they are subject to those same harms.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The transitional administrator made clear in his submissions to the district court.
Look. Things the transitional administrator said are different from findings by the district judge. Right? The transitional administrator is entitled to his opinion. So are you. And they may be entirely correct. But unless the district judge makes the findings, you know, we're a court of appeals. We can't make findings on our own. we can't make findings based on one side's assertion when the other side is saying, well, when the Cook County prisons are saying, we deny that there's a violation of the Constitution, we're reserving all of this. Now, these are issues for the district court, not for a court of appeals.
They are, and here, sir.
One other question for you. Why is seniority a violation of the Constitution?
I'm not sure what the context of that is, Your Honor.
State law says that these workers have certain rights, usually summed up as seniority, which they keep unless there's good cause for their discharge. The transitional administrator has entered, and the district court has enforced an order abolishing that right and saying they have to reapply for their jobs as if they were new applicants. Now, of course, if seniority rights violate the Constitution, that's a perfectly fine order, provided the district court makes the right findings. But I'm trying to figure out why, on your view, seniority violates the Constitution.
Your Honor, first of all, they don't have to apply for the same jobs. What the transitional administrator is doing is creating new jobs and eliminating old ones, which the district court appointed him to do. And the reason he's doing that is because he said, and the district court credited those statements, he reported, as a court-appointed official, that the children would remain in danger unless he was permitted to bring the facility's basic staffing levels and staffing qualifications up to minimum standards. Children will suffer unconstitutional deprivations of their rights. Now, we would have been happy to have...
addressing my question. If the district court finds, and again, I can't find any such finding, that the minimum staffing requirement contemplated by the Constitution is twice the level of the current staffing level, that the Constitution requires that, I don't understand why there is also an argument that the Constitution requires that the existing workers effectively be fired and required to reapply.
Your Honor, sorry.
Maybe I could imagine such a finding being made, but I can't find any such finding, and it's very difficult to see the argument for it.
The district court had unrebutted reports from the transitional administrator. The union didn't want an evidentiary hearing. We said we'd be happy to have one because we knew what the evidence would show. And the evidence did show that he couldn't bring this place into compliance with minimum constitutional standards without changing the credentials of staff. You've got staff there, not the majority by any means, but staff there who can't write a competent written report, staff there who can't supervise the kind of interaction with the children who have been suffering in violent and filthy conditions for a decade or more without changing the credentials of staff. The union's only other alternative for which they presented no evidence was let people try the new job and fail, and the district judge did make findings in footnote 7 about that and said that was going to subject the children to an unacceptable level of risk. The district court carefully reviewed the factual record, but the factual record, Your Honor, was undisputed. The transitional administrator, the only expert who spoke to the district court and who spoke about these issues, said, I can't fix this place unless I'm able to bring the basic staffing credentials and qualifications and obligations into line with what everybody's doing in every other county in Illinois and all over the country. The district judge also found the screening test he proposed was a good...
Do you believe that the Circuit Court of Cook County wouldn't do what is necessary if this prison were given to it, as Illinois law requires? I trust you understand what's underneath this. In addition to the jurisdictional problem from Kokona and the problem of compliance with the Prison Litigation Reform Act, the Supreme Court has said that the federal courts are out of the business of running prisons. That's what's going on here. We have a district court who has decided he's just going to run this prison. He's going to hire the staff. He's going to decide what the manning tables are. And I think the Supreme Court has told us that this is something that ain't going to happen.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has made it very difficult to have a federal court engage in ongoing oversight of facilities like this. We totally agree. And this is the case. This is the archetype where the facts and the record support that. I remind you that Cook County, which is the body that had the interest in asserting its ability to run the place, agreed that the appointment order complied with the Prison Litigation Reform Act. We had, I'll refer the court to the record.
At the same time as it was denying that it violates federal law.
Not at that time, no. The appointment order had made no such denial. It had made self-serving denials years earlier in the Memorandum of Agreement, which the court did not enter in its finding approving the agreement. The court found that agreement in compliance with the Prison Litigation Reform Act. But let's look at the time of the appointment order, Your Honor. We submitted a mountain of evidence, most of it from the court's own experts. The court was aware of this, that children were suffering, that they were at risk of dying, that they were living in filth, that they were being beaten every week and sent to the hospital by staff abuse and by abuse by other children. This place was a mess. This was exactly the kind of serious problem where courts do have a legitimate role. There's no federal decision that says courts don't. You have to make the findings on the Prison Litigation Reform Act, and this court made them. And Cook County agreed. The record was overwhelming about the suffering of these children. This facility has been a scandal in this community for more than a decade. We've had children hospitalized. We've had children beaten. We've had report after report of rodent-infested units, children sleeping on the floor and being attacked at night, children's lives disrupted. These are the children of this community. And this was a record, an undisputed record.
Counsel, this is not a closing argument to a jury. We're not going to make any findings. Questions I've been asking were, where are the findings by the district judge?
The district judge made those findings, Judge. It would be form over substance to say he has to recite every subsection of the Prison Litigation Reform Act.
If there had been a trial in this case, a full trial to the bench, and the district judge at the end had said, I find, and then just quoted the language of the Prison Litigation Reform Act and said nothing further, that decision would be summarily reversed. You agree with that, surely? Wouldn't comply with Rule 52. There'd be no findings of fact, no conclusions of law. You can't just say at the end of a trial, I find, and then recite the statutory language.
Parties could
here,
stipulate
there wasn't even a trial. Right?
There wasn't a trial because there was no dispute that this place was horrible.
But there also weren't any findings.
The district court had a mountain of evidence before it, and it found that this agreement complied with the Prison Litigation Reform Act. I don't think it had to go through the dance of reciting every subsection of the statute. I don't know of a case that requires that, Your Honor.
The problem is not reciting the statute. The problem is making findings and telling us its legal reasoning.
Your Honor, the red light is on. We would respectfully urge the court to let this process proceed and protect the safety of these children.
Mr. Levy.
Your Honor, John Lobey, here on behalf of the transmissional administrator. And before we go farther, we have to take a step back and look at the context for why the TA is here.
Could you tell me why the transitional administrator is a party? Transitional administrator appears to be an appointee of the district court. I mean, this strikes me as the equivalent of a magistrate judge filing a brief in the Court of Appeals when the magistrate judge has entered orders, which the district court has enforced. I mean, why is the transitional administrator a party rather than an adjunct of the court?
We are actually an adjunct of the court. We consider ourselves...
You're not a party. You can't be a litigant and an adjunct of the court at the same time.
Your Honor, in our view, the TA is exactly that, an officer of the court appointed by the court to get the facility into constitutional compliance, and that is what he is working every day to do. And the reason he had to do that is because for 8 years...
Are there any cases that you want us to look at? He's effectively a special master appointed by the court. Are there any cases that hold that a special master also is a litigant in the Court of Appeals?
Well, I don't have a case that justifies my right to stand in front of you, Your Honor. In our view, as an officer of the court, we split our time with the plaintiffs, and we'd like to address the court on why we believe that what the TA is trying to do is necessary to bring the place.
We haven't struck your brief yet, but unless you have authority for the proposition that a special master appointed by a district court is entitled to proceed in the Court of Appeals as a litigant rather than as an adjunct of the court, leaving the court's decision to speak for itself, that striking your brief and this appearance is a likely outcome.
Your Honor, I would express the preference of the TA to address this court as an officer of the court, as an officer of the court appointed by the district court.
If you're an officer of the court rather than the litigant, I think you have to sit down.
Your Honor, I will do whatever Your Honor directs me to do. I would like to address the court. If you tell me to sit down, I'll sit down.
I think you should sit down.
Thank you.
Mr. Block, anything further?
Just a few follow-up points, Your Honor, in response to some of the arguments made before. Initially, though, if the court desires, the union would be willing and able to brief the jurisdictional question that the court raised at the outset of my argument. The plaintiffs seem to want to have it both ways. They assert that the county's express statement that it does not admit to any liability is merely pro forma and has no meaning. And yet, the PLRA recitals that appear in the orders with no findings whatsoever, they claim is not pro forma. Submit that they can't have it both ways. But in the end, the plaintiffs seem to fall back on the allegations that they made in their amended complaint back in 1999, that the place is in danger, chaos, physical harm. But I'll remind the court that the district court below was very explicit on this one point, that there have been no such findings that those dangerous conditions exist. The court said there has been no judicial finding.
Look, it doesn't really matter at this stage, other than for purposes of Kokkonen, what the state of the world was in 2002. Transitional administrators appointed in 2007, right? And one would have expected to see findings in 2007 about whether the appointment of a transitional administrator was essential, least restrictive, the other things needed to ensure compliance with the Constitution. What's the state of findings on your view as of 2007?
Well, the portion I was reading from, obviously the appointment order contains no findings at all. The portion of the order I was reading from is the order that we're appealing from today, the order of the court authorizing the transitional administrator to go beyond the scope of these agreements and beyond and interfere with Illinois law. And even in that order, the judge acknowledged there has been no judicial finding that purging the JTDC of incumbent direct care employees is necessary to correct plaintiffs' alleged constitutional violations, nor has there been a specific finding that JTD residents currently face an ongoing danger to health and safety due to unqualified staff staying in their current positions. The court affirmed the point that this court is making now. There are no such findings. With respect to the newly created jobs, it would be a misnomer to say that they're completely different than the old jobs. They simply replace the old jobs, although they include additional duties and responsibilities. It's still the same job. The jobs that they currently occupy, the direct care staff, they are called juvenile detention counselors. Under the TA's, the transitional administrator's plan, those jobs won't exist anymore. They'll be replaced by the youth detention specialist. The plaintiffs also assert that the reason there's been no hearing and findings is because the union never requested such a hearing. And had the union requested such a hearing, there would have been one and there'd be findings. Well, we respectfully submit that's not the responsibility of the employees to demand such a hearing. It's the plaintiffs who have brought this case. And if the plaintiffs want to interfere with the employees' rights under state law, it is incumbent upon them to have the court conduct a hearing and make findings, which it has never done. Finally, the plaintiffs allege that assert that Cook County agreed to the appointment order, and that's true. Cook County did sign off on that appointment order, but it's also very clear from the face of that order that the transfer of control of the JTDC to another entity, the chief judge of the Circuit Court of Cook County, was imminent. And in fact, the appointment order specifically provides that the transitional administrator is to assist in the transition of authority over to the chief judge of the Cook County court system. Plainly, at this point, by the time the transitional administrator was being appointed, the nominal defendant, Cook County, had checked out. They no longer were interested in this case. They filed a certificate of non-interest in this appeal. And the true defendant in this case, the entity that is to be running the Cook County Juvenile Detention Center, has never been made a party, the chief judge of Cook County. Thank you.
Hold on a second, counsel. Before you go, is the Circuit Court of Cook County a proper party? Who, under state law, who is the proper litigant here?
Proper litigant. You mean the proper defendant?
Yeah.
I believe that under state law, the chief judge of the Circuit Court of Cook County should be the defendant.
The chief judge of the Circuit Court of Cook County is the manager of the prison system. Does that change the juridical status of who owns and operates the prison system from Cook County to somebody else? I think we need to have that addressed, too, because if we don't have the right parties here, we have an even deeper problem.
We've certainly raised questions as to why the chief judge, who at least administers that facility, has never been brought into this case and is not even subject to these orders.
Okay. Well, it's clear from this argument, counsel, Mr. Block, Mr. Wolf, Mr. Lovey, that we're going to need some supplemental filings. We invite the parties to file within 21 days briefs addressing what I think now are six distinct questions. One, whether a consent decree has been entered in this case. Two, whether the findings required by the Prison Litigation Reform Act were made either in 2002 or 2007. Three, how this affects subject matter jurisdiction under Kokkonen against Guardian Life Insurance. You can find that in Volume 511 of the U.S. Reports. Four, whether the union, as opposed to individual employees, is the appropriate objector. Five, whether the transitional administrator is entitled to appear as a litigant in the Court of Appeals. And six, who is the correct defendant in this litigation today? All right, we will enter an order memorializing those. That's why I've given you 21 days rather than the usual 7 or 14. But it's obvious there are a bunch of complex problems that we need to get through before we can decide where we're going with the issues the parties have raised. So I will look forward to receiving those supplemental submissions from all three of you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement when those submissions are received.